Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The recent killing of an Iranian scientist has ramped up tensions in the region. We'll talk about what this means for the Biden administration. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's our lead story today on The Takeaway for Monday, November 30th. Also on the show, with the rushed census this year, some census workers are sounding the alarm on the technology used for the process.
This app was sending them on these zigzagging routes that were really inefficient. It kept crashing.
Also, a look at federal executions happening for the first time in 17 years, with more to come in the waning days of the Trump administration.
This is just something that the Trump administration wants to do. It figures that it is more important now to execute prisoners than it is to concentrate on other matters.
Plus, there's lots of talk about Latino voters, but you'll only get the real scoop from our series, A Votar, with a look at how Latinos actually voted this year. There's a lot of news to get to, and we're going to start with a story out of the Middle East that could have significant implications for U.S. foreign policy.
Anger flares up following the killing of an Iranian nuclear scientist.
Killed in a targeted attack that saw gunmen use explosives and machine gun fire.
Iran's supreme leader is calling for definitive punishment.
The Iranians are going to be in a position where they have to retaliate. I don't see any way around it. And that's not going to be good for anybody.
On Friday, Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a targeted attack reportedly carried out by a group of gunmen. Fakhrizadeh was one of the leaders of an Iranian military nuclear program that U.S. intelligence agencies determined was disbanded in 2003. Iranian officials quickly blamed Israel for the attack. Israeli officials have not yet commented publicly on Fakhrizadeh's killing, but the country has been one of the leading critics of Iran's nuclear program. Iran has also accused Israel of carrying out a series of attacks on Iranian scientists from 2010 to 2012. For the United States, however, the killing raises major questions when it comes to relations with Iran under President-elect Joe Biden. Biden has said that he would move to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal if Iran once again complies with its terms, but Iranian officials might lose their willingness to improve diplomatic relations with the U.S. if tensions continue to rise during President Trump's final weeks in office. Joining me now is Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter who writes about Iran for the New York Times. Farnaz, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Tanzim.
So Israel has not officially commented yet on whether they were behind the killing, but how much evidence is there that they could be responsible?
Israel, usually when they carry out these covert operations, seldom do they publicly claim it. It's been their long-standing sort of strategy. In our story in the New York Times, we did say that three intelligence sources have told us that Israel was behind the attack and they had planned it for a very long time. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was Iran's top nuclear scientist and sort of the brains behind the operation of its nuclear program. So he was one of the prime targets for Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned his name in a presentation and said, remember this name. And, fits in the same pattern of covert operations that have happened this year in Iran. There was an attack on Natanz nuclear facility that intelligence sources believe Israel was behind. There was the assassination of Al-Qaeda's number two in Tehran in August, and now this one.
Well, have we heard anything from U.S. officials so far about the attack?
No, U.S. officials are not commenting at all about this attack publicly, and they haven't said anything. We know that because of the close alliance that Israel and the U.S. have, if Israeli carry out an operation like this, at the very least, the U.S. would know. They would be aware of it and would know that it was happening.
One of the things that's interesting here is that the U.S. intelligence agencies said that the nuclear program that Fakhrizadeh led ended in 2003. So what happened? What role has he played in Iran over the past decade?
He, in addition to being the top nuclear scientist, he was also the the top advisor for the defense ministry and may have been involved in the development of Iran's missile programs. Iran says that for the past year since the pandemic hit, he had been also overseeing research at the Ministry of Defense's research facility for a coronavirus testing kit that was made in Iran and also an Iranian vaccine for the coronavirus. So he had multiple roles and led multiple research programs for Iran's defense ministry. But in response to why would Israel take him out if he wasn't directly linked to the nuclear program? Look, I think Israel has had two goals here, Israel and the U.S. It's to undermine or delay Iran's nuclear program, because I don't think they can wipe it away with assassinations. It's, you know, there is a whole infrastructure for it. But also really to throw a big rock at a potential Biden and Iran diplomacy. Many of the sources that we speak to, even inside Iran, view this not just as an assassination attempt on Iran's nuclear program, but an assassination attempt at diplomacy with the U.S.
Why would that be in Israel's interest? Please remind us again.
Well, Israel has been against Iran's nuclear deal. They supported and praised President Trump's decision to exit the nuclear deal and to impose tough economic sanctions on Iran. And they are very much of the view that U.S. should continue the tough measures on Iran, the sort of maximum pressure policy that the Trump administration has been enforcing. They are against any potential sort of engagement with Iran that would give them some sanctions relief or that would allow them to, you know, do business with the international world. And we know that the Biden administration has said that it will look into returning to the deal, perhaps with some conditions, but that that is on the agenda. Iran and Biden will have a different relationship that the Trump administration had with Iran. And there's, you know, chances of negotiations or talks. And I think that this was meant to sabotage that effort.
Is that, Farnaz, potentially why this attack happened in the final weeks of President Trump's administration as it winds down, as we transition to a Biden administration? Could that be part of the reason?
An attack like this probably took a while to plan and to execute. But we have seen, and I think the Trump administration has clearly both displayed and said that they plan to escalate the pressure on Iran as they're exiting. I mean, almost every week they announce sanctions and designate new Iranian entities and new Iranian officials on sanctions. And these efforts, I think in sort of the last stretch, are definite, you know, in the opinion of many Iran watchers and also Iranians in Iran, it isn't kind of a last minute effort to try to make it as difficult as possible for the Biden administration to engage Iran.
We know that Joe Biden is picking his cabinet as we speak. Are you seeing anyone in the cabinet who could potentially, and national security positioned, who could tell us a little bit about Biden's administration's approach potentially to dealing with Iran?
The national security and foreign policy team, from what we have seen so far, are people with the view of global engagement and diplomacy over going unilateral, and particularly Jake Sullivan, who has been named the top national security advisor for Mr. Biden, was involved in the nuclear talks. He was the person that went to Oman to engage the Iranians before the talks started and sort of laid out the framework and the grounds for the negotiations that went on. And Anthony Blinken has also been a supporter of the Iran nuclear deal, as well as many of Mr. Biden's appointed foreign policy team. So for the Iranians, this is a team that, unlike the unpredictable nature of the Trump foreign policy team, this is a team that they know. It's a team that they have talked to, have dealt with, and it's just more predictability and stability for them in terms of going forward with Washington.
If this attack was carried out by the Israelis, as your reporting shows, Fardaz, could this also be not just an attempt to thwart diplomacy between the United States and Iran, but also an attempt to test support for Israel under a Biden administration?
That could be it. I think any U.S. administration has a close alliance and a close relationship with Israel. That's whether it's a Republican or Democrat. The Trump administration, for the administration of Netanyahu, was particularly favorable because not just of its policies on Iran, but also some of the policies that it took with Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the Golan, naming the Golan Heights, moving the embassy. So the Israelis, the new administration may not be as, how would I say, accommodating to Israel's policies even internally, but they will definitely have a close alliance. And, you know, we have seen that Mr. Biden hasn't commented on the assassinations, but we've seen some, senior Democratic officials and people who were involved in the Obama administration foreign policy come out and condemn the assassination and say that this is not helpful.
And I'm just curious, Iran has a presidential election of its own coming up in the next year. And I'm wondering how that could affect relations between the U.S. and Iran, if we know anything about who might be in the running for that position.
Well, Iran's presidential election is in June, so that leaves the government of President Rouhani and Foreign Ministers Javad Zarif, which are viewed as a centrist government with a more pro-Western approach, only a four-month overlap with the Biden administration. So for the Iranian government, time is of essence. If they want to start having any sort of engagement with the U.S., they want it to be quick, and they want some sanctions relief quickly, not just for their own legacy, but they think that whatever happens with the Biden administration and the nuclear deal will impact and affect who is elected in Iran. If some of the sanctions are lifted, if President-elect Biden returns to the deal, there's a chance that the next president of Iran will also be a more moderate centrist. But if, you know, the assassination of the scientists this week has made the hardline voices in Iran that are against any interaction, any concession to the U.S. much louder. And if this continues, if these sort of actions and provocations continue, and if there's no return to the deal, we might see a Revolutionary Guards commander or a military person or a hardliner taking the presidency, and really sort of that conservative hardline faction of Iran consolidating power. So there's a lot at stake, both inside Iran domestically and also, as you mentioned, with going forward between U.S. and Iran.
Farnaz Fasihi is a reporter who writes about Iran for the New York Times. Farnaz, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Throughout this election cycle, we've been covering Latino voters and the issues driving their votes in our series called A Votar. Nationwide, exit polling data indicates that the percentage of Latino voters who supported President-elect Joe Biden in 2020 was about the same as the percentage who backed Hillary Clinton in 2016. But on election week, many media outlets scrambled to figure out why a majority of Cuban-American voters in Florida cast their ballots for Donald Trump this year. And even though it appears that President Trump made some significant gains among Latino voters in Florida, in other key states, including Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, Latino supporters were a key part of Joe Biden's victory. Breaking all this down is Mark Hugo Lopez, the Director of Global Migration and Demography at the Pew Research Center. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we mentioned that Latino voters back Biden in similar numbers to what we saw to Hillary Clinton in 2016. But Mark, by the state level, were there any noticeable differences that you saw from 2016 turnout to 2020 turnout?
Yes, Florida was the one state that you really notice is different. So back in 2016, Hillary Clinton won about 2/3 of Latino voters' vote in Florida. But this year, Donald Trump won about 46% and Joe Biden 53%. So Biden still won the Latino voters' vote in Florida, But it was by a much smaller margin than we had seen with Hillary Clinton back in 2016.
A lot of that, of course, came from Cuban-American voters, right, Mark?
That's right. In fact, Cuban-Americans were one of the groups among Latino voters that we have good detailed information about, and you see a change in their support. So back for example, the Obama years, they were leaning more towards the Democratic Party. In fact, Obama won a majority of Cuban voters in Florida back in 2008 and 2012. But this year, Donald Trump won 56% of the Cuban vote, compared with 42% for Biden. Again, these are from exit polls, and I want to stress that exit polls are a great source of information, but they're surveys and they're estimates, so these are not hard and fast final results. But they do point to a story that suggests some changes in Florida among Latino voters in support for Biden versus Trump, compared with previous elections.
Let's talk a little bit, and thanks for the note on exit polls. Let's talk a little bit about other groups. What about Mexican Americans? Were there any distinct voting patterns that you saw there?
Yes, and this is where Texas is another state that had some interesting results in this election. So if you take a look at the counties that are along the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas, in South Texas, many of these counties are 95% plus Hispanic. So when you look at the voter turnout results from those states and how people voted in those counties, you'll find that, for example, this year, Donald Trump won a larger share of voters in those counties than Hillary Clinton. Than he did back in 2016 when he was running against Hillary Clinton. What you see is for example, support for Trump in some counties went from about 20% to maybe almost 35 to 40%. So a notable increase. And this isn't based off of an exit poll. This is based off of actual counts and tallies from those counties. But that is another area where we saw a shift, and that's largely a Mexican-American population. So it's notable that there were some other places in the country where we saw Donald Trump make some gains among Latino voters.
Were any of those gains based on gender, or like what can explain some of those gains, Mark? Because we talked a little bit about the Florida case in which Floridians were sort of inundated, Latino Floridians in particular, inundated with a lot of misinformation and campaigns. But what's the story in Texas? Do we know?
Yeah, it's really great. This is, a great question and a great part of the story about Latino voters in 2020. So the Cuban vote, and also I'd add the Venezuelan vote, which is another group of Latino voters that people talked about in Florida, alone are not enough to explain the support that Trump got this year among Latino voters nationally. Nationally, his support, according to the exit polls, was at about 32%. That looks to be about the same as 2016, when maybe he got about 28%. And I say the same again because these are surveys and they have margins of error. But what's also interesting here is that you've seen a growing gap between Hispanic men and Hispanic women, at least in their support for Republican and Democratic presidential candidates since 2008. This year, Hispanic men were more strongly for Trump than they were back in 2016. Another group that I think is important to note, though we don't have exit poll data for them, is third generation or higher generation Hispanic Americans, people who are U.S. born with U.S. born parents. They tend to be in the Southwest, tend to be Mexican American, and that Texas story we talked about a little while ago may be a part of that reflection of the third generation playing a role and leaning more towards the Republican Party, at least according to Pew Research Center polls. I'd also note evangelicals, and when we talk about evangelical voters among Latino voters, you'll see that, for example, evangelicals supporting Donald Trump this year among Latino voters nationally, more so than, say, back in 2016. So again, these are cases where you're seeing some shifts among Latino voters, and I think that it's not just about Cubans and Venezuelans, but it is more broad-based across the country.
I want to talk a little bit about Puerto Rican voters. We focused on them here. What did they do this year, Mark, that was interesting?
Well, Puerto Rican voters are important in a state like Pennsylvania, where the majority of Hispanics who live there are of Puerto Rican origin, and in Florida as well. And in Florida, where we have some good data on this, the exit polls say that Florida's Puerto Ricans supported Joe Biden 69 to 31% for Trump. Now, this is important because Puerto Ricans match Cubans in size in terms of population and in voters in Florida. And this is really something that's just emerged in recent years. So Puerto Ricans played a big role in helping Joe Biden win in a state like Pennsylvania, and also to help them in how well he did in Florida.
And do we have any information on first-time voters, Mark?
Yes, this is really interesting because when you talk about Latinos, so many are young and so many are first-time voters. And it looks like among Latinos who voted, according to the exit polls, 37% of them this year were first-time voters.
Mark, this has been a year that has been really characterized by so many things, including protests for racial equality. Was racial inequity a major issue for Latino voters this year, many of whom themselves are people of color?
Yes. In fact, it was the issue cited most as the issue that mattered to their vote this year, according to the exit poll. 39% said racial inequality was the thing that was important to their vote. Now, that's ahead of 28% who said it was the economy, 8% who said it was a coronavirus, another 8% who said it healthcare policy, and 11% who said crime and safety. But interestingly, the exit poll also has some other findings in there about race, about Black Lives Matter and Latino voters, which is interesting. So, for example, Latino voters are split about whether or not they have a favorable or unfavorable view about the Black Lives Matter movement. 49%.
And does that depend on who they are, Mark?
It does. You find that Democrat supporters or people who supported Joe Biden tended to more strongly be in favor of something like Black Lives Matter, but those who supported Donald Trump were less likely to have a favorable view of the movement.
What about age? Were there any notable discrepancies in terms of age?
So the usual patterns that we see for Latino voters on age were present. And I want to stress that across all age groups, Joe Biden won all age groups of Latinos, no matter how you cut the data. But you do see that, for example, among younger Latinos, somewhat stronger support. And among older Latinos, interestingly, also somewhat stronger support. Both, almost 70% of each of those two groups supported Joe Biden, compared with about 28 to 30% for Donald Trump. But those in between 30 and 64 were somewhat less likely to support Joe Biden, relatively speaking. About 62% of those two groups, for example, supported Joe Biden, compared with about 34 to 35% for those who are supporting Donald Trump.
I know many people want to be done with the election, but there's still one more election that's critical, and that's happening in the state of Georgia, Mark. There are two major Senate races coming up there. Is there any indication from any of these exit polls that could tell us anything about the role of Latino voters in Georgia?
Well, it's a place where Latinos are a growing share of voters in the state. And this year, Latinos overwhelmingly supported Joe Biden, 62 to 37. But also what's interesting is in close elections, a Latino vote perhaps might even be of more importance because of the relatively close election results that we've had, both for the presidential race, which has been decided in Georgia, but also for these two Senate races. So it looks like this could be a very interesting place where Latinos could play an important role once again in the upcoming runoff elections.
We got about a minute left in the segment, Mark. Was there anything that stood out to you this year that was unlike other years?
Yes, it's the way in which we've talked about the Latino vote. And we say Latino vote to describe it as in a simple way, but that also implies that it's a group of people who have similar viewpoints. But I think the one thing that really came across this year is that most of the discussion started to focus on the differences and the diversity of the population. It's kind of one of the reasons why I say Latino voters as opposed to the Latino vote. But it is interesting that this was a year where that diversity was recognized both before and after the election.
A lot of that is part of your work. And thanks so much, Mark, for being with us. Mark Hugo Lopez is director of the Global Migration and Demography section of the Pew Research Center. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can go check out all of our A Votar series at thetakeaway.org under the Special Projects tab.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This summer, the Trump administration announced it would be resuming federal executions for the first time in 17 years. The federal government has since executed 8 people, and it has scheduled several more to take place in the coming weeks. If those are carried out, the planned executions would be the first to occur during a presidential transition in more than a century. For more on this, we're joined by Robert Dunham, the executive director of the Nonpartisan Death Penalty Information Center. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what explains the latest push for federal executions by the Trump administration?
Well, I think the only way you can explain it is that this is what the Trump administration does. It has no historical precedent in the United States, and there's no corrections reason, no penological reason for doing it. So this is just something that the Trump administration wants to do. It figures that it is more important now to execute prisoners than it is to concentrate on other matters.
What was the state of federal executions before the Trump administration took office?
There had been no executions in 17 years. Part of that was because a lot of the cases had not gone all the way through the appellate system, but mostly there was a lawsuit that was filed in the early 2000s challenging the method of execution that the federal government was using. And that lawsuit was working its way through the courts and then was finally halted by the federal government when they said, well, we don't have execution drugs, so this doesn't make sense to go forward.
So the method that was being used was lethal injection, I think, as many of us lay folk understand it. Is that right?
That's right.
And what was the issue with that method? And what are the new alternatives to this practice that the Trump administration is proposing?
Well, initially, the drug protocol that the government was using was a three-drug system. The first drug was supposed to knock out the prisoner and keep him or her unconscious during the execution process. It was followed by a paralytic agent, and then it was followed by potassium chloride, which is a chemical that would stop the heart. There had been a number of botched executions, and some of the supplies of the drugs, some of the first drug, had become unavailable. So the government was searching for different drugs, and drugs that the states were using were resulting in extended and painful executions. So nothing was happening during the first couple of years of the Trump administration. But apparently they were able to find a supply of a different drug, pentobarbital, and decided they were going to conduct executions using that single drug. It raised a whole series of problems because that was not what the protocol was before, and the government circumvented the usual process for adopting regulations. So then in July of last year, the government announced that it was going to carry out a series of five executions, and it selected prisoners who were not part of the original lawsuit. A lot of things happened after that, but essentially it resulted in the executions being halted while courts decided some of the preliminary issues. And then again in June, the government decided it would try to conduct more executions.
Let's talk a little bit about who's helping facilitate this, because there have been a couple of attorneys general under the Trump administration, perhaps, and the one that's most recent is Attorney General Bill Barr. What's his role been in all of this?
Well, Bill Barr is an advocate of executions, and nothing had visibly happened before he became Attorney General, although it's certain that things were going on in the background. The government was looking for suppliers for drugs. It couldn't use the major pharmaceutical companies because they do not participate in executions. But we think that was going on in the background. He also has been in the forefront of a number of policies that have politicized the Justice Department. And this appears to be another one of those.
Robert, what stands out to you about the fact that the Trump administration is trying to execute people during this presidential transition, which really has just a couple weeks left to go?
I think what stands out is how historically anomalous this is. No lame duck president had carried out an execution in more than a century. This administration is attempting to carry out five more executions, during the transition period. And in all, after it executed Orlando Hall, the first in a century, in all, it would have six executions. That's significant because the most we have ever had in the history of the United States was five executions during a transition period during the presidency of Chester A. Arthur. And that goes back to 1884 and 1885. And during that time, the transition period extended until March 4th. Now we're in a period in which it extends only to January 20th. So that is historically out of step with everything that we've seen in American history. It's also out of step with what's going on in the United States right now. This year, obviously, is a year unlike any other because of the pandemic. But this year, there will be fewer executions by the states than any year in the last 37 years. And there will be fewer new death sentences imposed in the United States than in any year since the death penalty came back in the country in 1972.
And Robert, does that indicate, what does that indicate? Does that indicate a change in terms of how federal officials and state officials view the death penalty? Or is that how many Americans support the death penalty? What does that indicate?
All of that. Support for the death penalty in the United States in public opinion polls is at the lowest level in 50 years. More Americans think that life without parole is a more appropriate option, and fewer than half of Americans think the death penalty is fairly administered. We've also had 10 states abolish the death penalty in the last 15 years, and the number of new death sentences imposed has dropped by 90% since the 1990s. So what we're seeing out of the federal government is completely contrary to the direction the rest of the country is going.
I wonder if any of the people who remain on this list have any options in terms of clemency or legal options to halt these executions, given that this is happening in a presidential transition.
There are a number of options, but challenging the execution because it's in transition period is not likely to succeed. But people like Lisa Montgomery, who is scheduled to be the first woman executed in nearly 70 years, she currently has a stay of execution. The government rescheduled her execution into January. Lisa Montgomery's lawyers were unable to prepare her clemency petition because, forced to travel during the pandemic, they contracted serious cases of COVID. And so a court granted a stay of execution. Rather than allowing meaningful time for the clemency petition to take place, this government simply rescheduled her execution for January, and it remains unclear whether she's going to be able to take advantage of the clemency process. Alfred Bourgeois, who is scheduled to be executed on December 11th, is almost certainly intellectually disabled, which would make it unconstitutional to carry out his execution. And he currently has a stay of execution in place, and the government scheduled his execution anyway. So there are things going on in courts. We're not sure how they're going to play out, but we do know that what the government is doing is completely out of step with what prior governments have done.
And of course, I'd be curious to know, you mentioned Lisa Montgomery is the first woman who would be executed in almost 70 years. I'm wondering whether or not there are still racial discrepancies among those who are scheduled to be executed or who have already been executed by the federal government.
What's interesting is that federal death row is overwhelmingly composed of defendants of color. But the first set of executions were all white defendants. And part of that, we believe, was to kind of tamp down on any argument that the executions were racially motivated. What became very interesting about that is that all of the executions early on, and so far all but one to date, only one has involved a black victim. So when it comes down to whose lives matter, it's clear that in these cases, the lives of white victims matter to the government more. And what we're seeing is two of the youngest people, the only two teenagers as offenders to be executed by the federal government, are scheduled among this group. They are both African American, and that follows the history that we have seen with both the federal death penalty and state death penalties, that if you're young and black and a defendant, you are much more likely to be sentenced to death and executed than anybody else.
And Robert, just finally here, there is an incoming administration. Joe Biden's administration will be taking over in the next couple of weeks. Is there anything that the Biden administration can do to prevent any of these federal executions once they've taken office? Biden has said he is against the death penalty and would work to end it.
There's nothing that the Biden administration can do to halt the currently scheduled executions. But once they take office, they can stop all executions after that. They have the power to grant clemency in individual cases or everybody on the row. It's likely that they will conduct a study of the federal death penalty to do a thorough assessment. They want to seek to repeal the federal death penalty, so they can try to do that through statute. And of course, one of the things that we're likely to see almost immediately is that the government will decide not to seek any more death sentences. So you will see no more cases being prosecuted as capital cases, and they may drop the death penalty in the cases where it's currently charged.
Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nearly 100 census workers around the country said they had trouble doing their jobs this year because of problems with the technology that was used to get information from Americans for the 2020 census. That's according to reporting from Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. This year, census workers were outfitted with cell phones and a mobile app that was supposed to help them gather data quickly while in the field. But some workers who spoke to Reveal said the technology had a lot of glitches and that the overall process was rushed because of shifting deadlines from the Trump administration. Here's one census worker who spoke to Reveal.
It did start to feel like our attempts were being sabotaged. It got to be pretty demoralizing. Between the data not saving or our phones not working or giving us the wrong start times.
In a statement to Reveal, representatives from the U.S. Census said that they stood by the technology used this year and noted that they had hired more than 300,000 workers to conduct the 2020 census. Here with me now are two reporters from Reveal. Byer Duncan is an engagement and collaborations reporter, and David Rodriguez is the collaborations and community engagement specialist. Welcome to you both.
Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Byer, tell us about the way the census was carried out this year, which was different than prior years.
Well, to begin with, this was the first time it was carried out using predominantly an iPhone app, a new iPhone app that had some problems from the start. And then what we heard from enumerators across the country was that this app was sending them on these zigzagging routes that were really inefficient. It kept crashing. It took forever to charge their phones in the middle of their shifts. And some of them would see data from their enumeration efforts just disappear in the middle of their shift.
David, this was the first year that this technology, I received a visit from a census worker who took the census on their phone in about 10 minutes. It seemed pretty efficient, but what were some of the technological glitches, David? And how did workers try to get around those?
So some of those glitches are that the app itself would crash during mid-interview. So imagine you're a worker and you finally have someone that's willing to talk with you during this non-response follow-up operation. And one thing that we've heard a lot about is while you're doing this interview part, the app just crashed on you and you had to wait for it. You had to come back later. So workers are assigned cases, addresses to follow up to, and that changes per day. So depending on what happens, like you're either going back to the same house or you're not. Another one was the issue of the GPS sending you completely to a different address that isn't where you're supposed to be, kind of ping-ponging you around town. If you're in one apartment and then you go all the way across town and then you come back to the first apartment again. And then another one was like the iPhone itself, that the battery would drain pretty rapidly when it lasts you the shift.
Byard, how did census workers think to get in contact with you guys over at Reveal?
So David wrote an initial story that sort of chronicled the technical problems a lot of these workers were having. And then as part of our reporting, we created a web form that census workers could reach out to us through. And we heard, after David's initial reporting, we heard from about 100 of them. And we're still hoping to hear from more. You know, anybody listening could text census to 474747. And I have to say the robotic voice thing of, you know, standard data rates apply. But we are still hoping to hear from more folks. And our reporting on this continues, obviously, as you have a Supreme Court hearing today. And further developments about the census later on.
Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court hearing. What's expected?
Well, my understanding is that today's hearing is over this question of whether or not Donald Trump has the ability to exclude undocumented folks from the count. I think the Supreme Court ruled earlier that he wouldn't be allowed to include a citizenship question, but in July he issued a separate memorandum basically expressing that he has the ability as president to exclude folks from the census, and that would go against hundreds of years of census precedent as well as other laws. But we're going to have to wait and see what the Supreme Court says today, and I believe there are oral arguments happening very soon.
I mean, this sounds like it could have been a difficult process to undertake, but did any of this actually affect the data? David, do we know if any of these technical discrepancies actually affected whether or not people were able to complete the censuses? Because as I said, mine was done in about just a couple minutes, you know, at my door.
So right now we're in this process, the data, post data collection process. And we don't know that right now for sure. We'll know it once the Bureau does the quality checks. And like every census is very hard. Every single one. It happens every 10 years. And there are communities that are historically undercounted in the census. And then on top of that, on this year, we had the pandemic. Over here on the West Coast, we had fires. A lot of things happened this year that was already going to make the census even harder to count people. So we don't know the implications of the issues that workers were dealing with. But one thing that they've shared a lot with us is their concerns about some of the things they were being told to do.
I'll just add that we heard this again and again from census enumerators and supervisors, this idea that external pressure, you know, pressure from the Trump administration to speed up the process was creating on the ground this environment of sort of like competition or really high urgency to close cases, even if there weren't proper enumeration attempts. And one thing that's been really striking about this is, you know, if you have a system like the census that has historically grappled with including marginalized people to begin with, mm-hmm. it doesn't take some, you know, master scheme to make that exclusion worse. You know, you just need to introduce a little chaos on the ground. Then the corners that get cut, you know, they end up disproportionately hurting those people even more. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing here, whether it's enumerators driving around and counting people who live in RVs and being instructed to assume just one person lives in those RVs, or whether it's, you know, enumerators outside of apartment buildings estimating how many people live there based on the number of bikes or cars parked outside. I think what we might see is that pressure ultimately affecting the count of people who historically have been undercounted anyway.
And was this concentrated in a specific region, the folks that reached out to you, or were you hearing from people across the country?
This was all across the country. And what we heard is now being echoed in a bunch of other places. There's a lawsuit from the Brennan Center for Justice, where enumerators and supervisors have told very, very similar stories about pressure to close cases without proper efforts to reach people. You know, as for the ultimate consequences for the data, like David said, we don't know yet exactly how this will affect the data, but we have some troubling indications. Recently, in a 4-sentence press release, the Census Director, Stephen Dillingham, said that the Bureau had found some anomalies in their data. And NPR just yesterday reported that the Census's original goal of getting its final tally to President Trump by December 31st, this being, of course, the goal that they invoked to speed up the process so many times, they're going to miss that goal. And according to reporting from NPR, they're now actually targeting a January 26th goal, which means that the ultimate sign-off for this census is going to land in Joe Biden's hands, not President Trump's.
We'll see how that turns out. Byer Duncan is an engagement and collaborations reporter, and David Rodriguez is the collaborations and community engagement specialist at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Byer and David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
right, everybody, it's great to have you with us on this Monday after Thanksgiving. I hope you all had some time to sit back, reflect, and enjoy the time off. Now it's time to get back to work. Glad you're with us. We have a lot of important stories that aren't on the front pages coming your way this week. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.